accession number 30638, Mr. Peter Wayne, Reel 7. Now, after that, I mean, you obviously don't, you know, it was just a work, you know, a brief period in the Egham area doing this Polston, Lacey, doing this railway sleepers. What happened next?
It's very interesting. I'm sorry, I'm using this aid memoir. We were then actually, at that time, we ceased to be an alien company and were converted into a British company. I think this was sort of June, July. I think the...
Of 43.
43, yes. It was, I believe, after the disastrous Dieppe raid, the first one in 1942. I think the military authorities and the government were already planning perhaps an invasion of Europe. After all, it was getting very close. And we were certainly, we were just called number 251 company.
So where next then?
We are now in
July 43, I think.
July 43. I was then, the 251 company was then disbanded and all of our, that would be in the, it did not, actually it wasn't disbanded until after the war, but most of us were, we were transferred to other companies then. A lot of us were transferred. A 251 company, I don't know how they managed to exist, because most of us were transferred to various companies, and some of us were transferred to combatant units. It was at that time that I was interviewed whether I would like to transfer to the commandos.
Now, what do you remember of that interview? What were they asking you to?
They were fairly high rank. Well, they were majors, I think, or even a lieutenant colonel. And I think it was Lord Lovett who formed the number 3 commando, which had a lot of alien soldiers. And I was asked whether I would be interested because of my age, and they say you would probably get a field commission. And I was never a brilliant soldier, but the reason I think they wanted us was because of our education and the fact that we spoke fairly faultless and accentless German. They thought we would be the right material to be dropped by parachute and do all the usual things.
Now, how did you respond to that?
I responded to this by saying, right, I'll do what I can to win this war. Building Nissenhut was not very inspiring, and moving railway sleepers. However, I had a rather volatile mother who was not all that well in London, and I had a brother who was 6 years my junior. He was a teenager. My father was at that time still in Germany, living underground, and I felt that I was the head of the family, and it would perhaps be a little irresponsible if I went in for something which was so risky, and as it proved later on, it was extremely risky. And of course, we would have had to volunteer. And I remember my words to these officers were that I do anything I can, and it's not a question that we are all volunteers, even in the Pioneer Corps. But I don't think I want to take any additional risks, which we're already taking. And there it was. I must say they responded very positively. They say they can quite understand my position, and they called the next candidate.
So what unit were you transferred to?
I was transferred to the number 93 company from 251, and I joined a lot of old...
Now, hang on. When was that?
Alton. I think it was, must have been in October
43,
yes.
And where were they at that time?
They were in Southampton.
And what was the state of the unit?
Well, the state of the unit consisted of a number of people who had actually been evacuated from St. Malo at the days of Dunkirk. They were older than ourselves, and whilst 251 was a very young company age-wise, the number 93 consisted of some well-experienced soldiers who, of course, they were still aliens. I mean... They were Austrians. We had quite a lot of Austrians at that time. We then had already a Captain Miller, who was an Austrian, and Lieutenant...
So Captain Miller, you say?
Yes. The officers then were... Major was British, Major O'Dell. Captain Miller was Austrian. So were Lieutenants Ling and Stacy, but that is when I first came in touch, in contact with Geoffrey Parry.
We're interested in him mainly because we've interviewed him. He's done a very long interview. What was he like as an officer then, as far as you were concerned?
Well, Parry was. I always found him, of course. I mean, I met him so much afterwards. He was extremely pleasant. He was doing his job, and we were always thinking they were perhaps a little bit more officious than the British officers. But I noticed from his background that he was, he realized who we were, and whilst asserting authority, he was not over officious. Now, Captain Miller, who was Austrian, and we always wondered why he actually reached that exalted rank, he was a little more, trying to be, I think I use the term, holier than thou. That was his attitude. He was not unpleasant, but it's then that we noticed the difference between the Austrian and the North German education system. Captain Miller had a very strong Austrian accent, and whereas Parry, of course, spoke faultless English, as you probably have found out.
Now, what was the unit doing at Southampton?
We were doing camp constructions and in Swathling, and we moved to Southampton Common.
Anything about the time, this time? I mean, I know hut construction is a routine affair.
Well, it was hut construction. We were also doing loading and unloading work in Southampton.
On the docks? Or
on the docks. We were working in the docks.
What do you remember of that?
Well, we just saw a lot of ships being there was a lot of movement there. Don't forget, it was by that time, it was 1944. We were in May, we moved to Southampton.
I thought you were in Southampton.
Yes, moved to Southampton. We're doing camp construction. Then we were moved back. We were moved to Swathling, which were also doing camp construction most of the time. And then the Southampton docks. It was already March 1944.
So basically, most of it was in the Southampton area.
Was in the Southampton area. We did see at that time, I remember, there was an awful lot of movement going on. We were actually stationed on Southampton Common. And it was then that we were, by that time, of course, which I had omitted, we were fully armed.
Now tell me about that.
In other words, we had been issued with rifles. And we were also issued with Sten guns, which are these automatic, very primitive rifles. They had 56 cartridges in, and well, you would call them a submachine gun.
And what did you think of them? Had you had much training in them?
Yes, we had training in them. We were extremely cautious when using them. If you banged them hard on the floor, you would find that the bullets were released. They were effective, but they were nowhere as sophisticated as what the Americans had. However,
now, is it about this time you changed your name? You mentioned off tape.
Yes.
Now, tell me about that, because you changed.
Yes, we had we were at that time, of course, during our time in Southampton and Swathling, Southampton Common, we were getting a little more. As I said, we were fully armed. We were getting a little more military training, and we also were taught how to use hand grenades.
Remember that?
I remember that I was not a very good thrower of hand grenades. However, we practiced quite a lot, and we had this feeling, of course, by that time that something was going to happen. Nothing definite. It was just we saw what was going on.
About your change of name.
That we then were told that we should change our names, which of course was final proof that we were going overseas. I had, I remember we had very little time. I don't know why the War Office gave us such a short time. And I just did not know what to call myself. I wanted a short name. I wanted the same initials. So I chose this the name of this cowboy actor, John Wayne. It was shortened to the point. I have no reason. Most of my friends have since asked me, why did you change to that name? I said, well, my previous name was one syllable, and we had very little time. However, we changed that name, and we changed our names, and we were issued with new army books, army service books. We were given new numbers and new tags. You know, the tags that give our religion and all this, in case we had some. We then moved Udell Perry, December, January, March, still Southampton.
Still, it's 44 now.
44. 25th of March, we moved to, from there to Chandler's Ford. And in June, we moved to an ex-Batlin camp in Rustington.
Where?
Rustington.
Where's that?
Now, Rustington is very close to Portsmouth, where we eventually, of course, went over to Normandy. In Rustington, we had what I might call intensive military training.
And what do you remember of that?
Well, it was we were familiar, made familiar with loading lorries, again with ammunition and first aid. We were given quite a lot of first aid training, and we had lectures, which was quite interesting on military strategy. We had, but don't forget, we were still privates. So we.
When did you move to Rustington?
It was in June.
June 44.
44.
So was that before or after D-Day?
It was just after D-Day. I do remember in Rustington, I was again terribly worried about my folks in London, because we had doodlebugs, that is the V1, you know, pilotless doodlebugs, as we called them. They were pilotless. And whenever their motors stopped, you knew they were going to fall down and cause an explosion. You didn't know when, you didn't know how. However, in Rustington, being on the sea, it's quite close to Portsmouth. And it was quite interesting, because there were dogfights not dogfights, but some of our pilots, fighter pilots, shot them down before they even reached the coast. They intercepted them. They moved pretty fast, and so that was June. We followed the news, of course, all day long, and
On D-Day.
On D-Day. And we
How
knew.
How did you feel about D-Day? I mean, did you think it was the beginning? What did
We were very pessimistic initially, because we had remembered the Dieppe raid in 1942, when our troops, admittedly, it was only a trial run, or call it a dry run, but it was extremely bloody and unsuccessful. About D-Day, we again, we were rather worried, because initially the beaches were, which is all laid down in history, the beaches, it was not a walkover, as we had thought. The Americans got an extremely bloody nose, and enormous casualties in relation to the men they had. We were already we were prepared that it would not be a walkover, as has been, of course, borne out by the history afterwards. The fact that the Mulberry Harbour, this was a most impressive thing, that the harbour was actually pulled over from England to facilitate the landing at Arromanches, gave us hope. And of course, by the end of June, we had established quite a sizable bridgehead. There was a complete clampdown, I remember, on news. We were not allowed to communicate with our folks, and of course, all weekend leave was cancelled.
So what happens next then?
And it was actually in July, I think it was the 19th of July, when we were taken to Portsmouth. No, what was it called? South Sea, which is near Portsmouth, where on the pier we embarked in one of these landing crafts. I think there were about 50 of us. And made our way over to Normandy.
And that's so you get there on the 18th as well?
No, I think it was the 19th. I think we were loading, and we actually landed in Normandy on the 19th of July.
And so what do you remember about that crossing?
Well, the crossing was rough, and we must be honest. I mean, by that time, July, the 21st Army Group, I think it was, we had established a bridgehead. We knew we were going to land in enemy territory. But, and of course, I remember Caen, the capital of Normandy, was still firmly in German hands. There was some terrible fighting going on around there. And we realized that for the first time, we would be faced by a very strong, efficient, well-organized enemy.
Were you nervous at all?
No. Somehow, it was a form of excitement and, well, what's going to happen next attitude. There was too much going on to be really nervous. I mean, these landing crafts were no cruise ships, but they, nevertheless, they were quite stable. I must admit that I did not get my feet wet when we landed in Normandy.
Where did you actually land?
In a place called Port-en-Bessin, which is next to Arromanches. Port-en-Bessin.
And what happened when you landed?
When we landed, on the 20th of July, there were no Nissen huts. We were put into a field and asked to construct bivouacs, which means dig into the ground. We heard distant rumbling of guns, but not very near. Although later on, some shrapnel fell on our bivouac. The bivouac is you get a spade, you dig a hole in the ground, and make a sort of and then put your ground sheet over that hole to keep you dry. It was tough going. The weather wasn't good, and it was my first acquaintance with a drink called rum, because we were given rum rations.
What did you think of the rum ration?
Well, it was obviously to avoid us getting colds, and it was so wet. And it probably worked extremely well. Rum rations in the British Army were obviously they were issued only when things were really bad and wet. We were also then, of course, on army rations, which was a little tin box containing dried biscuits and.
This is a compo food ration.
Yes.
What were they like?
Very basic. Basic. There were five, I remember there were five cigarettes in them, which I passed on to my friends who were smokers, and which was to them a godsend. There were never enough cigarettes in those days. Some people were chain smoking because they were, I believe it was something to do with their nerves, being nervous. However, we dug in and well, we waited. I was, as usual, I tried to, because of being able, having been in Switzerland, my schooling and all that, I spoke reasonable French. I took, I had, at that time, I think we'd been issued with more cigarettes. I took my cigarettes and I managed to get the sergeant to drive me and himself to the next village where I collected, where I saw a farmer. It is farming country, is Normandy. And I must say, we were not very well received by the French. They thought we would be thrown back into the sea, even as late as July. I was very disappointed in, I would have thought we would be, you know, received as liberators, but nothing of the kind. First of all, a lot of them have lost their properties because of the heavy fighting. Perhaps understandable. Anyhow, I saw this farmer, and being rather bored with my biscuits and hard cheddar cheese, I said, "Have you got any camembert?" And he said, "No, we have nothing. The Germans took everything." I thereupon produced some cigarettes, and lo and behold, beautiful camembert was provided. He also had two young sons. I think they couldn't have been more than 11 or 12. And I said to him, could I borrow two of your sons to dig a nice hole into the into the meadow to construct a bivouac?" And I said, "There'll be 10 more cigarettes for that." And of course, these boys gladly, I remember having, first of all, a ride in a jeep. We weren't very far away because they had to walk back. It was a great adventure, and the cigarettes on top. They dug me the most comfortable and large bivouac. After all, there was six hands are better than two. With two, I remember two benches at the side, and we later on got an empty. Was it either a carton or a box as a table in the middle? It was so comfortable that I remember one of the officers, I don't know whether it was Perry or Stacy, one of the others said, "Well, how did you manage to get that bivouac, Wayne?" It was then that I realized if you can get somebody to do some work for you, it is a lot better than doing it yourself. It's an economic maxim which I tried to follow throughout my life, but not very successfully later on.